Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Knock at the Cabin is over, but we're just getting started here on Post Show Recap. My name is Grace. I'm here with my co-host, as always, Ariel. Ariel, how you doing?
What's up, Grace? I am here to talk about this movie, Knock at the Cabin, and I am excited because I think I liked it. Spoiler alert for, like, you know, or later in the podcast.
Yeah, what'd you think of the movie?
M. Night Shyamalan movie? Is that what it is?
Yeah. Every 18 months, he's like, you guys want another movie? We're like, okay. And then it's like either, you know, fine, maybe people would say bad to good. I liked this one. I thought this one was quite fun. We're talking about Knock at the Cabin. Of course, before we get started, make sure you subscribe. PostShowRecaps.com/movies. Ratings and reviews are always appreciated. I know many people have reached out recently chatting about their movie takes. Actually, somebody last night messaged me. Derek, a friend of RHAP, PSR, was like, are you doing Knock at the Cabin? I was like, yeah. And he's like, I need to sleep on it, but I don't know how I think about this. It's like, well, there'll be a pod eventually, and we'll tell you. And not too long from now, you'll get to listen to our thoughts. So I think Derek was less than impressed, which I think if there's we'll chat through the movie. But yeah, always appreciative for people to reach out. I know some people are going back through the Oscar noms movies that we've covered. I think we covered all but one of them. Maybe we have to rectify that at some point, Ariel.
Mayhaps.
Yeah. So let's chat about Knock at the Cabin. So I didn't know much about this movie other than that Dave Bautista and Rupert Grint and Jonathan Groff were in it. And I knew it was set at a cabin, and presumably someone would knock there. Mm-hmm. And I knew it was an M. Night Shyamalan movie, so I thought there'd be a twist. I didn't really know much going in. And I would advise people, I think you're better served not to read about it before you go. I don't know if you agree or not, Ariel.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always trying to avoid anything about a movie, even if it's like, if I somehow manage to see a movie without even seeing the trailer, I consider that a win. Even though I do enjoy trailers, I would agree. Especially, I mean, I think people are used to there being a twist with an M. Night Shyamalan movie, so I don't.
Yeah,
I know some people like to be spoiled, and I totally respect that. But I would always advise to.
I don't. Bruce Willis was dead the whole time.
Spoiler alert for his first movie.
No, but, that's this movie. Did you miss the part where Bruce Willis was dead the whole time in this movie?
They
never mentioned it, but he is dead the whole time during this movie.
I didn't know that Dave Bautista was playing Bruce Willis from The Sixth Sense in this movie.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you for a stupid joke.
that's the best thing to always mm-hmm. interrupt for. Mm-hmm. I think for sure I agree with you that we should be as uninformed as possible when it comes to these movies. That's the whole point in my book anyway.
So just generally, we should all be as uninformed as possible.
An uninformed electorate. That's what I'm talking
That's
about.
Right. That's right. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I think the standout is very clearly Dave Bautista in this role. He's very, very good in it. And so I don't want to spoil his role, but he's, I think, very strong. This feels like a breakout performance. He's been in a bunch of stuff. Like he's been in, I believe M. Night Shyamalan found him from his Blade Runner performance. Like, who's that? I want him in my movie. And he's like been in the Dune movie. And a bunch of, you know, obviously he's in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Marvel.
And his name starts with a G. Uh-huh. And it's, is it Grog? Is it Grog?
It's
Drax. It's Drax the Destroyer. I don't know who Grog might be from my home D&D game, so just bear with me.
There was also
And there's Groot. Groot
from the last Lord of the Rings movie. It's, yeah, sounds pretty close.
I'm so sorry. His name is Drax the Destroyer. I'm so sorry that I couldn't remember it. But
you should be sorry.
Anyway, I mean, like, yeah, he's so good in that, but I feel like this is like a pretty serious performance that he really gets to, like, you know, sink his teeth into, and he's very, very good. I in my opinion, I think the standout of the movie. And then I think the movie sort of flows as it goes. It really wastes no time. The pacing in this movie is delightful. This is one where I actually don't know that any time needs to be knocked off the runtime. It's like, yeah, 1 hour 40. I think it flows pretty well. Mm-hmm.
I agree, and I think it's nice to see movies not overstay their welcome.
yeah, and I think that the movie does what it's trying to do. It's based off a book. I know that he diverted from the book a fair bit, especially towards the end. And I know I went with a friend to see this, and he was like, "Yeah, I didn't really like the end, but everything up until that point was really good." Which is like, but not that the ending was bad, it just wasn't as good as the rest of the movie. And that's I think that's a fair assessment, and I rather enjoyed myself to check this out in a particularly like slow month of movies. And we're kind of getting back into it, but when your big competition this week is still Avatar and 80 for Brady, this is a good choice, I think, to go see Knock at the Cabin.
Yeah, I think you mentioned 80 for Brady and my mind goes blank. I think
with rage, my mind's filled with rage and anger,
flames on the side of my face. I really enjoyed this movie. I was looking forward to it in a way where I was like, oh god, I'm ready to be hurt again by M. Night Shyamalan. Like, yeah. I enjoyed the movie Old, his last movie. I do like this movie more. I thought Old was fine. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was like he seemed to be having fun. And I kind of felt like if this movie could be good, then are we at the beginning? I've seen other people point this out, so I don't think this is a particularly like original take. But I think I was thinking it, and clearly other people were also thinking it, of like maybe M. Night Shyamalan could get good again if he starts doing it great. And here, specifically, the thing that caught my eye that was interesting was he was sharing writing credit with two other people. So the idea that, like, maybe these people could help him not, like, give in to his perhaps more problematic instincts. And I mean problematic with it. That might turn people off from his... from his movies, or, you know, I think there was a period there where it was just like he became a laughingstock, and now I'm like, what if he's just to your point about like every 18 months he makes a movie, what if he just becomes a guy that makes like crazy movies for like the rest of the time, and some of them are great and some of them are not, and that's okay.
I believe the writing credits, not to burst the bubble, but I believe the writing credits are he found this screenplay that was written, someone had already adapted the book into a screenplay, and then he was like, actually, I'd like to do that. And so then he changed a bunch of he changed stuff. I don't know how much like Steve
Desmond, well, the point and that's yeah, a good but, that's a great note, but the point still stands only insofar as like it's not just his thing and he's kind of having to work with someone else's ideas. I think it's healthy collaboration, even in that form. I think is healthy for him specifically. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things, there's been this a couple of movies that have come out recently that have been theatrical releases. So I think Knock at the Cabin is one. I actually think Plane is one. These movies that used to be made a bunch in like the late 90s, the early 2000s, like you just get a ton of these, and it doesn't, you know, part of what I love about doing Pusher Gibbs Theater is that it does help me like keep up to date with like movies that are in cinema, and I'm much more on top. Like I'm watching as much as I can, and I feel like, you know, almost like I'm only missing like a few every once in a while that I'm like slipped through my cracks so I didn't get to watch. But there was a you know, Knock at the Cap, like this type of just sort of like, I don't know, an hour and 40 minutes, just go watch it on a Friday night. You know, I feel like we're missing a lot of these. Like it does feel like if you're not making, you know, like $700 million, then it's like a waste of time. And I really appreciate that there's been a few of these recently, as I think sort of movie releases are sort of like, we're getting the sort of the dam is breaking from all the stuff that like got delayed during COVID and mm-hmm. whatever, that we're getting sort of, yeah, like Plane. We didn't cover it here, but like I had a lot of fun with Plane because it was just like silly sort of popcorn nonsense that I got to watch for like, you know, an hour and 40 minutes. And
Plane
and,
was great. It was a lot of fun.
And they don't, I feel like they don't make as many of these, or maybe they just go to streaming, or whatever. So I sort of think there's a world where like, you know, M. Night Shyamalan comes out in 18 months and makes a movie and actually it's like bad. I'm so like, I don't know, try again. If you just keep like trying these different things, like you just make them, It'll be fun. Yeah.
We love, you and I have talked about before, and like, I especially like, we love a swing, you know, we're always gonna
not boring
it's not boring. We're always gonna appreciate like somebody trying to do something interesting and new, and you can't really say that he ever makes the same movie twice. You know, maybe structurally with the twist thing, but I think overall the ideas always feel very distinct, and like we should be appreciating that. I frankly feel now like we have, and I include myself in this, we have spent too much time like crapping on M. Night Shyamalan, and it's like,
yeah,
he's a creative person, and not all ideas are good.
Yeah, agreed. So let's I think I'm recommending it. I do think like if you're not a movie going person, this is when you can wait until it comes out on streaming and you'll enjoy it. But if you like going to the movies, I would say that this one as well, where it's like checking out. It got a very low rating, not in a bad way. I think it's a PG-13 movie, and so I actually think like there's actually the gore and horriness of the horror film is actually much more subdued than many other things I've seen at the movies recently. Mm-hmm. Looking at you, Infinity Pool. So if you're like super squeamish, I actually think this movie, either like if there are moments that are like you kind of see on screen, you never really super see things on screen. It's sort of like alluded to, and you can very like turn your attention away and know you won't like see anything. So, and gets the other advantage to the movie. Yeah. Cause I think it got a PG like 13 rating, which is, if you like looked at the script, I think you'd be like, yeah, this should be rated way higher than that. So.
Yeah. And I think there are a couple of times where they show stuff without showing stuff, I guess is a way I can say it. And
yeah,
that's how they get the PG-13. I think it's tasteful. Mm-hmm. And also it's going back to your like recommendation thing, if you're a Harry Potter fan, you might want to see this movie because it's Rupert Grint, Ron Weasley from the Harry Potter movie universe. So I imagine those people have gone out to see the movie.
Yeah.
True fans.
Yeah. It's so weird when he walks into the cabin and then they all go, "You're Weasley." It's so weird. That was so weird. That was so weird.
And he says, "Avada Kedavra," but it doesn't work. It's magic doesn't exist here.
All right. Let's spill the PSRT. Let me walk through the movie. So obviously written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan, based on an initial draft by Steve Desmond and Michael Sherman, based off of the 2018 novel. I combined the words novel and cabin there. The Cabin at the End of the World by Paul G. Tremblay. So Knock at the Cabin. 7-year-old Wen is outside, played by Kristen Chiu. She was great. She was really phenomenal. Good child actor. She's at a cabin with her parents, Eric, played by Jonathan Groff, and Andrew, played by Ben Aldridge. While Wen is outside, she's visited by Leonard, played by Dave Bautista, who, while initially like sort of gets along with her and seems pretty charming, he does upset her when he starts to be like, "Yeah, so my friends are coming, and we need you and your parents to like help us save the world, and you're gonna have to make difficult decisions." And she runs inside to get her parents. So Leonard and his companions. So we have Sabrina, played by Nikki Amuka Bird, Adrian, played by Abby Quinn, and Redmond, played by Rupert Grint. They arrive at the cabin saying that the family must choose to sacrifice one of themselves to avoid the apocalypse. And we really get into it like very quickly, I must admit. We get like sort of a home invasion scene. And literally like the first scene is like Wen being like Leonard walking up on Wen.
Mm-hmm.
And so every so often, one of the four of them will sacrifice themselves and unleash a plague. And if all four of them die, Eric and Andrew, and I guess Wen, will only have a few minutes to decide who they're going to sacrifice within their family, or the world will end. So Redmond is killed first, and we see a tsunami hits the western coast of the United States. And Andrew realizes that Redmond is the man who assaulted him at a bar many years earlier, and then immediately thinks, oh, this must have actually been like a planned attack. The next day, Adrian is killed and a deadly flu virus infects the Earth. Andrew manages to escape and get a gun from his car. Sabrina tries to stop him, but is unable to apprehend him, and so she runs off. Andrew comes back in, confronts Leonard, but Sabrina tries to run back in, and she gets shot, and so she is the third sacrifice. Planes start crashing all over the world. Leonard is sort of like held at gunpoint, but he's locked in the bathroom, and he sort of tricks Andrew into coming into the bathroom, thinking he's like escaped out the window. It was kind of clever, and attacks Andrew, is able to retake the gun. But he does end up sacrificing himself. And this is where the sky begins to blacken. Everything is dark. At this moment, Eric, who had a concussion from like the initial home invasion, believes the whole thing to be true. And he tells Andrew, you have to sacrifice me. You have to shoot me. He believes these people were the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And so ultimately, sort of reluctantly, Andrew shoots Eric and they leave with their daughter. The cabin gets struck by lightning and it burns down. And on the way home, Andrew and Wen see that all the disasters have stopped, and they turn on the radio, and Boogie Shoes, the song that they used to sing in the car together, plays. And that's the end of the movie. There.
What an ending moment. And I love that they're like, she wants to play it, and then he doesn't want to play it.
I love it. They keep turning it off and on. It's so good. Yeah.
It's very sweet and organic. Like it feels real. We have to start with the little girl. She's adorable. She's
adorable. When
adorable actor.
Yeah, Kristen Chiu nailed it, killed it. No.
Yes. Because you know, she is kind of like showing the fear, even though the adults do, you know, obviously this would affect a child the most. And the whole time you're kind of wondering, the whole time I was wondering, like, God, how do you even explain this to a therapist years from now?
We do see them in the future. Andrew has a vision of them in the future, and she seems to be totally fine. So,
yes. And I was really glad that they did that, because I think to your point, it's presented as Andrew Wright's vision. But who's to say that it's not real? Like in the same way that he believes, you know, that these visions are true, and that this thing that Leonard has come and kind of prophesied is actually now happening, and they're all watching it happen. Magic, quote unquote magic, a certain type of magic is obviously real in this world, and a flash forward could be real, and I think it's really sweet. We also got a bunch of flashbacks in this movie of their relationship, the two of them, mm-hmm. throughout the relationship, including when they go and adopt Wen, right? I believe is what we mm-hmm. see. Mm-hmm. So it's they're playing around with their history in a way that I think is actually emotionally impactful, and I was surprised. I was surprised at how much I actually cared about these people.
Yeah. So I mean, the big thing is whether or not this is true. I mean, he's clearly playing with like faith, right? Like the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse are named in this movie. That's what Andrew thinks they are. They all represent these, like Redman represents menace, and there's all the way that their jobs are healing, because Sabrina is a nurse. Mm-hmm. So there's all these ways in which they represent the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And essentially, like, the test for Andrew and Eric is as they start killing themselves and the plagues are happening on TV, because they keep turning on the TV to show that, okay, yep, the tsunami is hitting. Okay, the planes are crashing. The flu is, there's an outbreak of the flu. And Andrew is the one who really doesn't believe it. He's like, no, I think that like the tsunami would have hit way before they ever got here, which like there's a weird thing where there's like two tsunamis. One did hit, started 8 hours earlier, the tsunami hit, and then one that like does seem to happen as the movie is happening. And so he thinks that the whole thing is this, that they're just psychopaths, right? That they're maniacs who have come here and want to play this game and whatever, and they get off. But Andrew has Eric has a concussion. Mm-hmm. He got knocked. He falls down on his head, and Sabrina tapes up his head. But it, like he clearly is questioning it more, but then also can't tell if he's questioning it because whether he's in the right mindset because he has a concussion. Right. And
yeah,
so
concussion kind of gives him a, it's that interesting thing in the movie where it's like explaining why he might believe it, giving like a real reason for that and explaining why he has like this, he kind of sees at one point this vision of like a light, this kind of glimmer in the mirror that again could be explained very simply by sensitivity to light because of the concussion, but also is perhaps this supernatural force that is hanging around the cabin because now the four horsemen of the apocalypse have shown up.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So in the, I believe in the book, I am going to spoil the book for a second.
Oh my
believe,
God, I can't read. This is crazy.
In the book, I believe they do not make a sacrifice and the world ends.
Oh,
I believe is in the book.
Yeah.
So
that sounds a lot like humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. I walked out of the theater and I turned to my friend and I said, well, we all learned a lesson. The gays are selfish. because talk to Eric and Andrew, like the idea here is that their love is so powerful that their love for each other and their daughter, it is beyond, like they don't have to take care of Wen, but they choose to take care of Wen, and that's she's their daughter. She completes her family. And so he's also being like, yeah, and it's like me who needs to, because I'm the one who's sitting here being like, yeah, we have to do it. So, because like Andrew's like, well, kill me. And he's like, no, it can't be you. It has to be me. To me, the ending does work. I think it's pretty powerful. And then the apocalypse stops. There's a way in which like the way faith works that like I said this to my friend, and he was like, oh, that's interesting, which is there's actually no way to know that killing Eric is what actually stops the apocalypse. Like we don't know that, in the same way that we don't know that killing Redmond and then Adrian and then Sabrina and then Leonard is what unleashed all of these four apocalypses. So why I like the movie is because it does seem like the movie gives you a pretty straightforward answer in that them doing the thing that they were supposed to do, which is sacrificing the most beautiful love, you know, they're hand selected and picked. They sacrifice that love. And then the apocalypse stops. And there's also this thing where Eric's like, no, it had to, all four of them had to die for us to realize it was true. So there's that, they kind of explain like, to the point of like they're just being really selfish, like shouldn't they have decided this earlier? They could have saved this, but like they all knew what they were signing up for. They all have these visions. So to me, I actually like how there is really like, I think there's like an answer that most people walk away from this movie thinking is true, but that truth is only in faith that all these people were right, that they had visions. Because it's also in the movie, Andrew keeps poking holes and being like, you guys all met I thought you guys met randomly at the beach or whatever. And then they find out that they've been talking online. It's like, well, couldn't you have been incepted by like, couldn't you all have gotten the ideas into your brain? Like, you didn't have these visions, but like one of you said you had visions and the other one of you had visions. Like I thought all of that, like the way that like internet conspiracy shared delusion, I thought was like pretty strong. And I thought actually the ending to sort of like that, they do ultimately choose. And I think M. Night Shyamalan says that like the original script feels a lot like imagine Sophie's Choice, but you didn't have to make a choice. So I think he's like, you have to kill one of them.
Right.
And then the thing ends and then everyone goes on with their lives, except for all the people who are dead. And so I like that. I like that interpretation of the movie. I thought it was strong. I liked the plotting of the movie.
Yeah, I think the faith stuff is well told, whether or not, like, the movie isn't asking you to believe. The movie is presenting you with a situation where it's asking characters to believe, and all you have to do is watch them grapple with that.
Right.
And like the idea that Eric, as we keep saying, played by Jonathan Groff, is like the one who has faith, the one who has always had faith. You can just tell in their relationship. One of the things that works really well about their relationship is it does feel really lived in. And the biggest part of that, besides like the flashbacks that you get, is that push and pull of faith, where like Eric has a lot of faith and believes in things that Andrew clearly doesn't. And Andrew is very practical and pragmatic and wants to have explanations for things, and everything kind of just, you see the balance in their relationship. And I think in a way that is very, that seems very lovely and healthy and realistic. Mm-hmm. And to your point, you could kind of see it both ways. I mean, I do think the movie ultimately lands on, if you want to believe it, there's a lot of proof. Like, yes, to your point, it could be seen as a coincidence that these certain things are happening because of the way they're acting. And then the things stop when Eric sacrificed himself. But it's actually really beautiful in my opinion. Like, I do think I think Derek's point, right, of like the ending, I'm not sure about it. I think it might be the weakest. I think it's only the weakest in the dialogue that Eric's character has to deliver, of like a little bit of an exposition dump.
This,
like,
is yes, the thing that Ant-Man Shyamalan.
They're the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and they're doing blah, blah, blah. But like all that has kind of already been telegraphed and like told to you in a way that makes sense. So it's really just about Eric's character explaining it to Andrew's character and allowing him to kind of come to terms with it and believe it. And when Eric says, like, I think it has to be me because I'm the one, like, I've made peace with this idea, right? Like, I'm ready to die, which sounds like so outlandish, but in the context of the movie, I think actually makes sense. Like, he genuinely, believes that this is his purpose. And I think ultimately the movie worked for me because I had always made a joke, right? Of like, oh, one day M. Night Shyamalan's going to make a movie that doesn't have a twist, and that'll be the twist.
Right.
And in a way, this movie kind of doesn't have a twist. Like, and to be clear, in a way that I appreciate, because it's there the whole time. It's telling you what it is. And then ultimately, the only thing that you could even consider a twist is like, this thing might actually be true, but not a like hoodwinked, like blink and you missed it kind of twist that he normally comes up with. And I think that's the movie's stronger for it, because it actually is just like an emotional experience.
Mm-hmm. It's very impressive that they, and very true to life, that after like 2 hours of the flu pandemic subsiding slightly, they're like, well, guess the pandemic's over. That's great. 2 hours. 2 hours free. That's good. We're
to that point, there is a little bit, you mentioned it before about like there's a tsunami and there's another tsunami. I think there's like a little bit of like a timey-wimey element to some of the happenings in the house that actually make the faith stuff stronger in a way, in the sense of like you can think about it as if like, you know, there's like entities and certain like supernatural power dynamics going on, so it would make sense that they're perceiving time in a way that maybe isn't quite accurate. And mm-hmm. I like that the movie didn't like go out of its way, bend itself backwards to kind of explain every single little thing like that, as far as how like the time dynamics are working.
Give more money for the plane crashing CGI as well.
If you thought the CGI was bad, this, you should watch Plane. And I know you have. I'm talking to everybody else.
The outside of the plane shots, yeah.
It was still, that movie was still good, as you said, as crappy as some of those effects were.
And the other thing, too, I think the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, I think they represent, aren't they listed as like conquest, war, famine, and death? So I don't know, it's like, he's like caring when he, Leonard is like a basketball coach, but whatever.
Some liberties. There are four of them. They're not on horses, but that's fine.
What is
they weren't guns back in the day either. So.
It's menace, healing. Like, I can't remember exactly what Leonard is, but essentially like care, guidance, I think, is his thing, because he's a basketball coach. What is Adrian's thing? She has a kid, and she's not a school teacher. That's what
Avarice?
He is.
I don't remember.
What she.
I think
it's
selfishness because she kills herself. No, I don't know.
It's true. Anyway.
Yeah, I think it's That's the, because by that point in the movie, it almost doesn't matter. Like, you don't have to, that felt, you know, the like exposition dump that we get towards the end of Eric explaining everything. It's like, okay, and we can like fast forward through this part because ultimately it just feels less important.
Yeah. Boy, I thought Dave Bautista was like incredible in this movie. So he's the menacing part of the movie. He's arguably the most menacing part of the movie. And yet the whole conceit of the movie is that they appear menacing, and then when they show up, they're like, we're not here to hurt you. And actually, if you just like, if two of you actually walk out with this, totally fine, you know, and like, he just has this way. He's in a very like tight polo, you know, or like button up shirt or whatever. And so he like, you know, and his glasses. So he's like big and he has all these tattoos. And so he, you know, he's a former pro wrestler. So he's like supposed to be like intimidating, and like, and he is. And yet also the way he is able to, like, that scene where he's sitting with Wen and he's asking her these questions, they're collecting grasshoppers, and he asks her about why she has this mark on her lip, and it's because she had like a split lip when she was a baby and they had to have surgery. Like, he's so good at being able to like decrease his threat level while at the same time being the threatening thing of the movie. Like, the whole thing in the movie is like, is his trying to lessen his threat like purposeful or true? Mm-hmm. Right, like, is he doing it because he's like evil and he's like being deceiving, or is this person, are we seeing this person at their most vulnerable? And he just, for a guy who's just like not supposed to be a big, you know, dramatic, like, he's supposed to be the muscle in a movie, you know, that's what he's played historically his whole life, he's so good in this. He's so good.
Yeah, and I think he's clearly, it totally makes sense that M. Night Shyamalan saw him in Blade Runner 2049, where he played a very against what we had seen already from him type character. And like, just, I believe it was a scientist who wasn't, and he wasn't in the movie for very long.
No.
But he plays like a very intelligent, very soft-spoken scientist, I think. And it's, even just that in of itself was like, wow, this is so bold, like, to use him in this way.
Yeah.
And to your point, he's very good. He's great at the emotional stuff. He's great at the human stuff. The moments when he's talking to Wen, especially in the beginning, like outside when he first encounters her, like, he is very convincingly and seemingly organically a nice person. And they all four of these horsemen are, you know, they represent different things, and they all look different. And I think that represents like a thing of like, they could be anybody, and they kind of like live among us. And are they really themselves? Are they like spirits that have taken over these bodies? Cause ultimately they do all sacrifice themselves and they cease to live, and all their connections. Like, he's a teacher, right? And he's like a coach for a team. So like, now that team's without a coach, that sucks. This season's gonna suck.
Well, they were already not great. The teacher's like, the boys went like 4-8 and the girls were 5-6.
Oh, so he quit
on
them.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm not worth it.
He's not a great coach. Yeah. Sorry.
The season isn't worth saving. But yeah, I agree. He's really good. And I was struck by just like the emotion, honestly, from everyone. It's really intense to ask these people to, literally with the characters in the movie, I mean, like, to ask these people to sacrifice themselves willingly. And they all have like families, connections, you know, real world ties. And then really feeling the emotion, like I said, between like Eric and Andrew, that's the part that surprised me the most, because I certainly was not surprised at how impressed I was by Dave Bautista. But I think I was surprised at how much I cared about the Eric and Andrew relationship.
The other thing this movie does really well, we obviously get the flashbacks, but pretty much everybody from 10 minutes into the film has to just be sad, traumatic, upset, like trying to explain that you have to sacrifice somebody of your family to like avoid the apocalypse. Like, this movie like starts pretty much like, it starts with the home invasion. Like, it has the Wen Leonard conversation, and then it's like she goes inside and they come and break into the house. And so it starts like we get into the plot. So like, there's a world where this movie is like a bunch of the flashback stuff is done before, and then we get like Wen, and then we get right.
So lame. Yeah.
Right. But this movie, like, what I was really impressed with is like, we get into the meat of the movie so quickly, which is great. But then there is this added pressure that like everybody is playing the most emotional version of their character, right? Like, what Leonard is, but like certainly like Eric and Andrew, Jonathan Groff and Ben Aldridge are basically tied up for most of the movie having to like be afraid and sad, you know, like that's what they're being.
More afraid, more sad. Afraid again. Yeah. All right, let's take it again. More sad.
This is, what's that movie?
Babylon.
Like, Babylon, yeah. How many tears?
Cry, one tear, two tears.
Yeah. I did think Sabrina, who's played by Nikki Amuka-Bird, I only really know, I think she's in The Offer, which is a movie we did not cover, but I did like it. She's good in that. But yeah, we mentioned Rupert Grint in this movie as Redmond. And there's this plot point about, is Redmond not Redmond? He actually turns out to be, I think, like Rory O'Brien. And he's this man who went to jail for assaulting Andrew at a bar years earlier. And so there's this moment where he's like, oh, I think it's him. And Leonard's like, no, we're not playing that game because I know why we're here. I know we're here to avoid the apocalypse. I'm not going to go get his license and see what his name is. Mm. When Andrew's freed, he goes outside and gets his license and he throws it across and his name is Rory O'Brien or whatever. And so the movie confirms that Redmond, I think pretty much, is that Redmond is the man who assaults him at the bar. And so what do you, like, for me, I actually didn't think this was as clean as I wanted it to be. Even like the reveal that it's him, you're like, okay, I guess it's him. But like, they don't, I kind of wanted like in the flashback to the flashback where it's like, you clearly see that it's him or something like that. And I feel like there's a way in which like it complicates the narrative of the movie. Like I was really expecting that it's not that man and that Andrew was envisioning somebody who looked like him. Mm-hmm. And so that would, for him, that would be a thing that would like unlock that, oh, it's not a conspiracy theory. But what did you make of the fact that like Redmond is so intertwined with Andrew from seemingly years before and then shows up at this cabin?
Yeah, I like that Andrew has this, it's just an extension of his overall conflict with Eric's faith, right? Where he's like, he feels like he has an explanation for this thing that is actually just divine intervention, you can say. And I think the fact that it is the same person, I kind of was ready for it to be, I was ready for the movie to tell me one way or another and not really care. I didn't have a preference with whether I wanted Redmond to have been that man that was at the bar that assaulted him. I think the movie does reveal, like you said, that it is him, perhaps a little too cutesy with like the camera angles, where if you're really looking, you can tell it's absolutely him. I think it sounds like him as well. But to the point of like the Andrew and Eric thing, if Andrew believes, if Andrew is the one that has the memory, right? And if he believes that it's this person or not, that's ultimately kind of all that matters. Like I understand as we're talking about it now, like that whether or not like Redmond was that person is kind of an extension, like I said, of that battle between faith and coincidence, perhaps, or like believing and non-believing. But to me, it's like, if it is him, then that makes sense. It's like divine intervention. Like it's something that's above coincidence. Like how could these two people who met in this terrible circumstance now meet in these very different circumstances? It kind of has, for it to be the same person, it kind of has to be because of a supernatural force, in the way that, you know, sometimes coincidence is mistaken for fate or whatever. Mm-hmm. And also I love the idea that they make Ron. This person who's like famous for being like a really
nice guy,
good friend, yeah. Ron Weasley, just be like a total piece of shit.
Yeah. I thought it was, you know, it's fine. I kind of thought that, because I did think it looked a lot like Rupert Grint in the flashback as well. But then I wondered if we were going to get a second flashback that would like reaffirm that it like wasn't him. Mm-hmm. Like that Andrew, like the flashback is actually Andrew's like flawed memory is what I thought we were going to get. But nope, it's just full on him.
They're both in a mental institution. That's the twist. And they never got to the cabin.
Yeah. It's fine. You know, yeah, it's fine. We get this, you know, at the end where like when Andrew gets into the truck with Wen, which is, it's the truck that these people drove. They look through all their stuff and he's able to like confirm that these people were all seemingly telling the truth, right? Like Sabrina has a nurse's a badge. Adrian is like begging to not die and for them to choose to sacrifice one of them because she has a son. And then we see a picture of like her and her son. I thought it was a little bit like heavy, like to be, I don't know, to be like, oh my God, they have all these things that prove that what they were saying. I was like, yeah, okay. I don't know. Like literally he's just pulling everybody's bag. And was like, check, 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 check. You know,
yeah, because he's like, because he's a non-believer, right? And he's being asked to believe. I mean, you mentioned it before already, but to that point, like, I think the him and Wen getting away, and then we get that flash forward of their life, and she's an adult, and she seems successful, and they seem to be a really lovely family. Like, it's so sweet, and I absolutely choose to believe that it's true, and it just adds to like the emotional depth of the experience that they went through. You know, at the end of the movie, they both go before, you know, like ostensibly time wise before the flashback when she's still a little girl. They get to this diner and they see on the news that like all these, you know, the waters have subsided and the fake COVID is now also
2 hours free of cases. Right? We're all good.
We're good. And she's like, wow, I guess, you know, even as a little girl, she's like sitting there being like, wow, I guess it's all real. They probably can only talk to each other about it, right? Because who else is going to believe it is like kind of sad, but also sweet. This movie was good. It's like what it's like. It almost feels like M. Night Shyamalan made a quote unquote normal movie.
Yeah.
And I feel great about it.
Yeah, I think there's a world where I would have liked this movie to have a little bit less confirmation that like in my head, I want that like my thing of being like, we don't really know, like maybe, you know, I think it's like kind of like, you know, untrue. And I kind of like maybe imagining a film where it's a little bit more vague, like there's, you know, that they don't have anything in their that he doesn't get any confirmation that they are who they are. I think for me might be more interesting, but maybe doesn't work on like, you know, the level to which they want and need this movie to work. I think it did make its money back at least on opening weekend, so presumably we'll make a fair bit more than that, and it's will be
all the Potterheads showed up.
It's all the Potterheads. Yeah. It's all the wrestling fans, all Dave Bautista's fans.
It's true.
You know? Yeah, I love, we're big fans of the animal, Dave Bautista. Yeah.
These different, like, the Venn diagram of, like, fans.
Yeah,
and, like,
really.
Why
everybody... Jonathan Groff, like, Broadway fans, like, Brian Hamilton fans. Well, it's Ben Aldridge in before he was in this movie.
He has definitely been in something that I should remember, and I'm ashamed. That.
Oh, he's in that spoiler alert movie. He's the right, isn't he the husband? I didn't watch
that's right. Yes, I it Jim is Parsons. Now available he's... for streaming, but yeah. I did not. I have not watched it.
Oh,
either.
And he's in Fleabag. Okay, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, a jerk.
Yeah. Anyway, anything else about Knock at the Cabin?
I think people should see it.
Yeah,
I think it's you know, to your point, you don't have to run to the theater. It's not like the crazy tsunami and plane special effects are really worth seeing on that big ass screen. But I think for sure people should look out for it when it comes to streaming. If they don't want to go to the movies, I think it's a fun Sunday afternoon watch.
And you can't, I shouldn't go see it because you can go watch 80 for Brady like 5 times at the movies. So people should save it.
When am I going to watch this movie, Grace? I have to figure it out.
Well, Super Bowl Sunday. So, you know, instead of, I guess we have to do it before then. So
I guess, the only time I can go that's free is during the Super Bowl because everyone will be watching the Super Bowl.
Just if it hasn't been clear, we're going to be covering 80 for Brady later this week. Ariel, what else you got going on? What else are you podcasting about?
I am covering Dark with you and DM Philly, our favorite German Netflix series. Full spoilers for all 3 seasons, 26 episodes in total. Having a lot of fun with that. Covering Poker Face, also with you, Natasha Lyonne. Bow down to the queen. Having a lot of fun covering that. Episode 6, I believe, is coming out this week. Yeah.
Yep.
So we'll be covering that. And we're down to once a week now for this 10 episode first season run. And I think that's it for now. I am on Twitter at that other Ariel.
So I'm covering The Last of Us with Mike Bloom, the doing the recap, and the Video Game Club with Taryn. Also covering Mayfair Witches with Philly. And I have RJP Game Night where we play board games. We'll have a game in February later this month. I'm on Twitter at High From Grace. We'll be back later this week with more movie coverage. Until then, I'm Grace. That's Ariel. And this is Post Show Recaps Theater.